Tonight, we are happy to have the artist, Luca DeLaverson. DeLaverson. I told you I'd get stumped on it. Luca DeLaverson here from New York to share his work and his ideas with us tonight. With a BA in 2010 from Hampshire College in Amherst, Luca has had solo exhibitions in New York, Paris, and Luxembourg every year since 2013. So he pretty much hit the ground running and has participated in group exhibitions, including Midtown this year at Lever House in New York, The Art of Now at Hearst Corporation in 2016, Surface Support at Signal Gallery in 2015, also in New York, and From Prehistory to Post Everything in 2014 at the Sean Kelly Gallery in New York. Described as, quote, a thinker as much as a maker, a thinker who puts ideas into action through the act of undoing, by Benjamin Genocchio, previously the editor-in-chief of ArtNet, which is where that review came from, and currently the director of the Armory Show in New York. His review of Luca's 2015 exhibition at Jack Tilton Gallery in New York was one of high praise. He was incredibly taken with Luca's work and work ethic, stating, quote, exuberance is beauty, William Blake says, and Luca DeLaverson's show is nothing if not exuberant. Going on to describe Luca as having energy, ideas, ambition, and desire, along with an admirable sense of respect of art world elders and history. I certainly found the work I saw last spring and Luca's most recent solo exhibition at Jack Tilton to be exuberant, and it was clear that he is as much a thinker as a maker, which, of course, is what led me to extend the invitation for him to participate in this season's Tuesday evenings at the Modern, and I'm so very happy that he accepted that invitation. Please join me in welcoming Luca DeLaverson.
What's up, guys? Hey. I'd like to thank Terry and the museum, of course, for having me tonight. And for all of you to come in and hear what I have to say. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about how I got to where I am, the five solo shows I've had since I began showing my work publicly, and I'll talk about a few other artists along the way. That's me and my dog in my studio in New York a few months ago. So, as Terry mentioned, I went to Hampshire College in Western Massachusetts. I ended up there more because I hated high school, and I figured that this was the furthest thing from high school that I could find that was still a college. I began by studying 16-millimeter filmmaking. I was primarily making material-based sort of processed 16-millimeter films, altering the acetate on the film with chemicals, painting directly on the film, and I got really involved in this. At a certain point, my professors sort of took me aside and said, you know, you're pretty good at this, you work really hard, if this is what you want to do, you can do it, but you should understand that this is about as far as it goes, that you know, you can be a professor of 16-millimeter experimental filmmaking, or you can apply for grants, but that's it. So if what you're really interested in is being an artist, perhaps you should switch to painting, since your films are already so much like paintings as they are. So I did. And for the remainder of my undergrad, I devoted myself to that, to painting, to making mostly large sort of process-based oil paintings. And that culminated in a thesis exhibition of like systems-based abstraction that more than anything else was an emulation of the artists that I was most interested in at that time, which is, I think, how a lot of young artists get their start. You know, before you're able to build your own visual universe, you step into someone else's. So anyway, I graduated in 2010. I moved back to New York. And I was pretty immediately faced with two dilemmas. The first being that what I was doing didn't really seem interesting anymore, that New York City didn't need more abstract oil painting. There was already so much of it. And I needed to find something else to do. And the other, perhaps more pressing one, was how am I going to make any money? In order to afford the rent for a studio, of course, I had to have a job. So I got a job, a service job. I was a concierge at a luxury condo building, and I hated it. I was completely miserable. And I was fired, like, within a few months. And at that moment, I had a kind of realization that most of the young active artists in New York who I knew were rich. They were rich kids. They didn't really have to worry about making money. They were able to devote all of their free time to the studio. So I figured that I was going to have to find a way to live like one of them, like a rich kid. So I played up my expertise with 16mm film, and I went to a philanthropic foundation in New York, and I said, you know, I know you have this vast archive of 16mm films, huge archive, and I can digitize all that material, transfer it, and then create short documentary films for you, for whatever you want, internal purposes, you know, turn into an HBO documentary, whatever. And they said, okay. And they paid me just enough for me to, you know, afford my studio, cover my expenses, and I was able to work from home. This started as like an actual job, but the foundation was so big and there was so much money going in so many different directions that pretty soon they just sort of forgot that I existed. And I didn't remind them. They just kept paying me. So I was kind of like on an artist grant without them knowing it for 2 years. And during this time, I did what I had set out to do. I devoted myself to my work in my studio. And what I realized was I was becoming increasingly frustrated with what at the time appeared to me to be the constraints of oil on canvas painting. So what I decided to do was to substitute the paint and the canvas and the stretcher with epoxy casting, which is, you know, epoxy is like a two-part liquid plastic that you mix together, and it turns into this kind of like toxic sludge, and then it dries into a hard plastic. So what I did was I prepared a canvas, I stretched and gessoed a canvas, I laid it flat out on the floor, and I covered it with silicone, which is also a two-part liquid rubber, basically. It dries into like a hard but flexible rubber for making molds. So I covered it with silicone. When I peeled it off, what I had was just a total negative of the painting, right? Its depth, its dimensions, the tooth of the canvas, the surface inflection and brush strokes from the gessoing. And I got this idea that if I filled this mold with like 10 gallons of this epoxy, which was used for like mostly small crafting projects, you know, little doorknobs, stuff like that, that if I really maxed this material out, and if I sunk a sheet of glass into that cast, that the heat and the pressure of the curing would break the glass. And I decided to use mirror because I wanted... I also had an idea that, you know, the surface of the mold, this index of a painting, was going to create a surface that would trap light or somehow obscure or manipulate the reflective ability of the mirror to communicate any information. So what I got was this. That's the first one. The heat and the pressure from the epoxy casting caused the glass to break, and the shape of the cast to distort in the mold. You can see it's kind of an irregular rectangle. The glass is embedded inside the cast, so it's covered on all sides, front, back, and on the sides with plastic. And it also created, you can see a little bit, all these surface imperfections, these bubbling pockets where the mirror comes through undistorted. And you can see a little bit in this photo, but there's also an embedded stretcher bar mark, which also kind of was printed from the mall. And, you know, clearly the overall surface is incapable of really communicating information. It reflects light a little bit. You can see a little bit through it, but it has a satiny kind of finish that doesn't reflect. I'll show you a couple more. So around the same time I was making these, the foundation I mentioned before realized that I wasn't doing anything, and so they stopped paying me. And, you know, through these past couple of years, I was doing the things that artists do everywhere, but, you know, we're doing in New York. You know, I was going to parties, going to openings, trying to convince anyone who would listen to me to come to my studio to see my work. Jack Tilton, who's sort of a legendary art dealer on the Upper East Side of New York, he had come to my studio at the request of a friend like a year before that, and was more or less unimpressed, not interested. For whatever reason, I was drawn to this guy. He was like this old school, no bullshit New York art dealer. So I decided that I was going to call him again. And I convinced him to come back to the studio to see the new work, and this time he liked it. And within a few months of us working together, he offered me a solo show for the fall of 2013. This would be the first show, group or solo, since I graduated in 2010. So while I was working on the broken mirror paintings, I became increasingly interested in the surface imperfections, the bubbling I was telling you about. And since the general surface of the work is raised above these bubbled pockets, I figured that I could paint with a roller all over the surface and that these little bubble compositions would still be there. So by adding epoxy to the casts gradually, not all at once, I stopped the glass from breaking. And once it had hardened, I gessoed over the surface. I chose gesso because I wanted to take the work sort of back to the model, back to the original gessoed canvas that the mold had been made from. And so by experimenting, I found ways to manipulate that process by making, you know, to make the bubble areas larger or smaller, depending. This, of course, is the reflection of the room inside the uncovered areas. This is my first show, or half of my first show, at Jack Tilton in September of 2013. I decided to leave the room completely empty except for this one wall where I hung five of these large format glass paintings. This is the other room, my show. These are some of the painted works. Okay. So after the Tilton show, I was invited to participate in a group show in New York, and I wanted to produce something new. I had this Martin Barre book. Martin Barre is a French painter from the mid-60s, credited as being the first artist to use spray paint in a painting, you know, whether he was or not, who knows. But the paintings are all these small, like this big, little just white ground paintings with black arrows painted on them, just a single black gesture. The arrows usually go left to right or right to left. And I like the idea of appropriating these images, for one, from the, you know, the historical context, obviously. But at the same time, the works were like signs, you know. You know, they direct you where to look. And at the same time, you can't really credit anyone with inventing the arrow, right? I mean, yeah, Martin Barre made arrow paintings, but, you know, the Native Americans made arrows too. So I scanned the black and white pages of the book in color, and I blew the images up so that the color dot matrix became visible. So that, you know, it's a black and white image, but it's made of like this webbed system of tiny little colored dots, like red, yellow, and blue dots that you see on closer inspection. And all of a sudden, you know, it's this black thing, black and white thing made out of color. I changed the orientation so that my arrow is always pointed up, and I printed them on large sheets of paper, and then used the same epoxy that I'd used for the glassworks as like a paint or a glue that I sort of messily applied to adhere the images onto painted black canvases. And like the glassworks, this is a series that remained ongoing for a few years. Okay, so here I want to talk a little bit about perspective. This is Simone Martini's Annunciation painting from the 14th century. It's a subject we see a lot in pre-perspectival and Quattrocento Italian painting. Quattrocento just being, you know, a 15th century Italian painting, which is mostly the transition between Gothic art and early Renaissance art. This, you know, the angel Gabriel here letting Mary know that she's going to conceive Jesus. And for whatever reason in this painting, she just doesn't seem excited about that at all. anyway, you know, so perspective in painting, which this is not necessarily the best example. I just happen to really love this Simone Martini. You know, it orients you when you're standing in front of the work. It shows you where you are in relation to the things in the field in front of you to help you better understand what's going on in the picture. And we think of perspective as a given, I think, because we all grew up with photography, right? So we think of it as more something that was, like, discovered. But if you look at a lot of this early art, late Gothic, early Renaissance art, you actually see that it's more something that was invented. And you see these guys kind of figuring out how to do it. How to, you know, sometimes they get it right, sometimes they get it really wrong. But for me, watching them diagram this out is really fascinating. So the next one, so this is also a Simone Martini painting. This is a really weird painting. And I guess, you know, to me, it's like when you're standing in front of this, it doesn't really situate you as though you're in front of the work. It's like you're inside and kind of around it. It almost feels to me like if you went to see like a play and that set designer was some like psychedelic architecture genius and created like a half skateboarding half pipe for all the actors or figures to stand on, and that, you know, at any given moment, you know, the figures are, the ground is undulating and the figures are coming up or down or, you know, forward or backward. There's something about it that really captivates me. Anyway, moving on. So my first show in Europe was at Zidoun Bazouit Gallery in Luxembourg. The gallery's built, it's a townhouse, sort of built into the, like, this rock wall. It's a really interesting space. I used this show as an opportunity to continue pushing the glassworks. I introduced black and white mirror into the process. I think this is a good place to expand a little on my thinking about these broken mirror paintings. As I continued to make them, I began experimenting more and more with the process. When I let the glass break in the mold, it came out more or less the same way every time. So I began ironing sheets of adhesive that's used by like art conservators to reline old paintings, onto the verso, the reverse sides of the glass, and then breaking the glass in different ways. The adhesive used so that you know, you're not basically setting off a bomb or something. The whole thing stays attached to this thing that you can then peel off, and you have the however it broke. So, you know, I was snapping it, dropping it, throwing things at it, etc. And afterwards, you peel off the adhesive, and you put the whole thing back together like a puzzle inside the mold. And although I had initially been really interested in the system I had set up, where I was basically just facilitating something and then allowing the work to create itself, I got really more interested in this way because it became like about love. You know, sitting over a mold filled with like curing toxic chemicals, putting little glass shards in it and trying to perfectly arrange it, it's like grueling, you know? And it made the resulting work just that more satisfying. So, you know, that's the process part, the way the thing is made, which is, I think, is interesting and unique. And then there's, of course, the historical part. You know, how these works fit into a larger historical trajectory of modernist and avant-garde painting and sculpture. Obviously the clear referent of Duchamp's Large Glass, and then many others. This constant drive to find a new way to make a painting, which in this case, the thing isn't technically a painting at all, right? It's like an avatar for a painting. It's a sculpture of a painting. And then there's the part that I actually find the most compelling, which is the magic part, the way that the objects become associative. And depending on who's standing in front of them and, you know, what time of day or where they are or whatever, you have all these different associative reads. They might look like, you know, water or ice or, the sky. And if there's a fracture in the middle of the work, it might take on more of like a landscape association. If the thing has more of an all-over broken composition, they look more like abstract paintings. So that silver piece on the right there was made by smoothing out the mold before I made the cast. So the work, it has like this watery characteristic, kind of, and it's considerably more reflective than the broken ones. If you stood at arm's length in front of it and went out to touch it, you would see your fingers would be perfectly reflected in its surface, but you would be distorted. So depending on where you look at it and where you're standing, it's just a completely different thing. And then that piece on the left is black glass that I painted over with white gesso. And that's another silver painting on the right, of course. And the left, that's white glass with black gesso painted over it. This is a Jack Goldstein painting from the 1980s. It's made from the a diagram of the body heat of a human being. Jack Goldstein is a very important artist for me. There may not be a lot of obvious visual parallels, but my interest in the aesthetic of thermal mapping in some of my more recent work, which I'll show you a bit later, comes just as much from these Goldstein paintings as from any of thermal mapping's, you know, real-world applications. So my second show at Jack Tilton opened shortly after that show in Luxembourg, also in the spring of 2015. Here I made broken mirror paintings out of colored glass and installed them over the windows of the gallery. And these change dramatically depending on what the weather is and what time of day it is. So this is like a bright midday afternoon. If you came in the evening, they would turn the entire space like give it this sort of bluish glow. It just completely changed the vibe of the room depending on what the time of the day and the weather was. There they are installed. Funny aside about this room, FDR and Eleanor Roosevelt were married in it. It wasn't Jack Tilton Gallery at that time. It was presumably like the house of a, you know, socialite New York friend of theirs. But the ballroom at Tilton Gallery is where they were married. Okay. So while I was working on this exhibition, I became really interested in prison tattoos. First the French ones, and then I discovered these books of Russian prison tattoos that, like, blew my mind. They're all coded, and they have these, like, various visual signifiers to identify what the prisoner was all about to the other prisoners without them having to, you know, verbally communicate. And, you know, needless to say, the translations are, like, horrific and horrible and violent. But I was drawn to them, and I liked the idea of turning them into cartoons, like making them sort of pop and light. I painted these and stenciled them directly onto glass, and then I cast them the same way I had cast these silver works that you saw before so that they have these same kind of watery, smooth surfaces. And this painting was shown up, propped up against the mantle on Budweiser cans as a kind of homage to the artist Katie Noland, who made these big sculptural installations in the late 80s, early 90s, using Budweiser as a kind of symbol of like American machismo, like grandiose masculinity, Budweiser being kind of like as American as the flag itself, same color scheme, whatever. And then, you know, I sort of crushed them with this painting that I liked how it sort of drew out the weight of the thing itself. These casts are like 150, 175 pounds. So my main focus for this exhibition, though, was this video idea that I've been trying to figure out for around a year. excuse me. One of the things that really interests me in the Broken Mirror works is how the surface of the cast distorts the ability of the glass to communicate information. So what I mean by that is that although these things register as paintings, and I talk about them as paintings, they aren't actually paintings, right? The only thing in them that is painting is the print of the canvas that transfers from the canvas to the mold to the cast. So I thought that if I could somehow create that same effect with a moving image, that it would open up new territory. The problem was if I just dropped like an LCD monitor into a mold filled with epoxy, it was going to fry the TV. So what I did was I created a plexiglass box that the LCD fit in perfectly, like really snugly, and then the box itself was only like 3/16 of an inch, the depth of the actual plastic. And then I made a mold of a canvas that was the exact size as that box, or, you know, a sliver larger. So the screens fit into the box, which also has this painted cast around it. And I programmed each of the TVs to play different popular Hollywood movies from the 90s, like the movies I'd grown up on, Jurassic Park, Independence Day, Home Alone 2, Lost in New York, which I think is better than the first one. you know, while the images on the screen are totally distorted, you can kind of see here, there's no video of this for whatever reason, but they sort of look like lava lamps. The audio isn't distorted. And these are, you know, on loops. So at any given moment, you have this like crazy cacophony of sound, and every once in a while, you know, these little pieces of familiar dialogue or soundtrack would bleed through this constantly changing wall of sound. So you'd hear like the Jurassic Park theme all of a sudden, or like Macaulay Culkin being like, "I'm not sorry at all." And because they're all different lengths and they're looped, at any given moment in the space, it's going to be a different auditory environment. It became like a, you know, the audio being in constant flux became this like embodiment of the, you know, pronouncement that you can't step into the same river twice. Okay, so this is Las Meninas by Velázquez. And to me, this painting is just like a big question mark. I saw it at the Prado in Madrid, where it lives, and it's, you know, it's huge. And I was just completely drawn into it, trying to decipher what the allegory is, how it's all laid out, who's who, what the painting is about. You know, we have Velázquez himself standing in front of the canvas. We see the back of the canvas. In the mirror in the back, that's presumably the subject of the work, which would be us. Or it's a reflection of what he's already painted. We don't know if he's about to start painting, if he's taking a break in the painting. And then we have, you know, the Infanta and these whatever court people standing here, almost as though they're supposed to be the subject, but standing next to him. This guy in the back with the door, it's like almost like he's opening up a portal. And I guess the more I think about it, the more I think that it's a painting about the nature of representation itself. And I'm just really, it's like one of my favorite artworks ever. I'm really drawn to it. Okay. So in early 2016, I did another solo in Europe, this time in Paris, at Gallery Natalie Obadia. This was probably my most arcane and eclectic show. And the combination of that and its use of French cultural material as content made it somewhat unpopular with the French. But I really loved this show. Martin Barre, the era painter, is dead, but his estate is run is represented by this gallery. So I thought it was an interesting venue to, you know, debut some, to create some more Arrow works. And his wife actually came to the opening and told me that she liked my work when it looked like her husband's work. I was like, well, okay, thanks. Thanks. I also produced a new video work, this time using Guy Debord's Society of the Spectacle, which is a French film with a continuous voiceover with Debord speaking about American consumerism and pop culture, its effects on society. And then I matched that with a compilation video that I made called A Personal History of Punk Rock Attitudes, which I made with roughly an hour of footage of some of the bands I grew up listening to. It was like concert footage, music videos, kind of all put together. And the exhibition ended up having a sort of soundtrack of this French academic speaking mixed in with American rock music from the 80s and the 90s. And it was disorienting and a little abrasive, but I thought it was pretty cool. And this time I laid the screens around the gallery, you know, obscuring some of them. I made a single broken mirror work, which you see there in the corner. This time I made an inkjet print on the surface of the mirror of a color spectrum, just like ripped right off of Photoshop. And you see the mirror at the fracture points kind of highlights the composition that the breakage creates. Here's one of the Barre paintings I made. This time I cropped the arrows and made my own compositions. This one was kind of a mistake, actually. I had created this up and down composition, and then I don't know if you're familiar with the magic wand tool in Photoshop, but I like pressed it by accident and it created this crazy thing that I was like, what the fuck is that? But I thought it was cool. And this time the dot matrix isn't made up of like red, yellow, blue. They're like these really bright fluorescent colors that I don't know where they came from. So I just went with that and let Photoshop make this one. Okay, I also made two entirely new works, photographic for the first time. I had this font made based on the font of the Russian prison tattoos, and I used the same printing technique as before to create a black and white image out of color parts. You know, it's important for me that in all of my work that everything is somehow connected, that it's all part of the same visual universe, even if, you know, the images or the objects appear disparate at first. So I applied this font to Stefan Mallarmé's poem, A Roll of the Dice Will Never Abolish Chance. This poem is still the subject of a lot of debate. It's known for its visual quality. The placement of the words on the page and the font size can combine to create a number of different readings, depending on where you start it or how you read it across the page. You can create like an infinite amount of variable poems. And I took that and I laser cut it into a sheet of plywood so that, you know, the text is basically burrowed about, I don't know, an eighth of an inch, maybe a quarter of an inch into the surface of the plywood. And then on top of that, I printed these images of women in Kabul in Afghanistan in 1979 during their Cultural Revolution. And this wasn't really necessarily an outward political gesture. I was just really kind of interested in the mystery of these photographs. The fact that, you know, the women, free to wear whatever they want, looked like they could have basically been anywhere. They could have been in any Western city. And then the direct address of so many of the figures also kind of brought it back into this like dialogue of painting that I liked. This is Luncheon on the Grass by Manet from 1863. In my experience, this painting is usually discussed in terms of the incongruity of the nude female figures with the clothed men in the picture. But to me, what I think is really interesting is how perspective is completely collapsed. And it looks like the woman in the back in the pond and her whole surroundings are like on top of the figures in the front. And to me, what that sort of like signifies, what excites me about that is it seems like an early example of when 19th century painting began to be concerned with these modernist attitudes of you know, the thing itself, painting as an object, that the object of the painting is as important as, you know, whatever the painting is depicting. And that's also that central female is the same prostitute that Manet used in the Olympia painting of the same year. It's a good year for Manet. All right, and then on the other side of that coin, we have Seurat, I think. And, you know, most people think of Seurat as, like, the epitome of late Impressionist bourgeois art, right? Like, it's pretty prominently featured, the Le Grand Jatte in the back in Ferris Bueller's Day Off. It's like an it's like a poster in every fourth grade elementary school classroom. But to me, I think the same way that Manet was pushing painting towards this sort of modernist endgame of flatness and objecthood, Seurat was involved in this epic project of de-skilling, which is just as important in the trajectory of Western art history. And by creating a system by which virtually anyone could make one of these paintings, right? Like, if you were willing to devote the time and the concentration, it's paint by numbers. Like, you could make this if you wanted to devote whatever years to doing it. And I think that he posits this sort of new attitude where painting does not necessarily revolve around the virtuoso genius, but about a thinker who creates a system and then facilitates it. So that the painting kind of makes itself through the execution of that system. And in this painting where Le Grand Jatte, you know, the most famous work, is painted into the background behind the models, I see that as kind of demonstrated as like a game within the painting. Okay, so after my Paris show, I spent some time traveling. Went to Morocco, Mexico, South America. When I got back into the studio that spring, I was rummaging around and I opened a box that had the stencils I had used to make the tattoo paintings. And the stencils were all on top of each other in this box. And they, you know, they had been vigorously painted. And looking at them all overlapped like that, like stacked on top of each other, they looked like pretty interesting abstract paintings. I liked the freedom of the brush strokes, which had been made incidentally while filling in the empty spaces from the stencil. And it was like painting that didn't have any art in it. So I scanned all these stencils separately and I started experimenting with overlapping them. When I printed the images on gessoed canvas, they looked like posters and I really wanted them to feel more like paintings. So for the first time in like 5 years, I started making oil paintings again. This time just white, thickly painted surfaces on canvas that had the texture of something like a de Kooning painting. And once the oil was dry, I put the paintings through a huge flatbed inkjet printer and printed the stencils on top. There they are in the studio. The stencils themselves had been small, like, you know, 12 by 16 inches. And once they were blown up to the scale, the modest brush strokes took on this kind of like monumental quality, which I liked, but I also thought was like kind of funny. And the result was something like I hadn't really seen before. Although printed painting, inkjet printing is everywhere, obviously. I had never seen inkjet print on top of a painted surface before. So they became these like representations of paintings printed on top of these abex surfaces. Here they are in my third solo exhibition at Jack Tilton, which opened this past spring. So while I was developing the tattoo paintings, I was brought back into this world of oil on canvas painting, which is really pretty different than anything else I'd been doing. I found that it had this weird quality, almost impossible to describe, where a painting is like just simply good or bad. You know, you can tell by looking at it. A good painting speaks for itself. So I started thinking about painting as like a kind of wilderness, like a jungle or something. And I thought back on those Jack Goldstein body heat paintings and of this Chris Marker film, Sans Soleil. In Sans Soleil, towards the end, there's a film within the film where a fictional artist creates a virtual reality based on the zone from Tarkovsky's Stalker, which is a place where a person's deepest and truest desires become a reality, like, you know, almost always to disastrous end. Anyway, the aesthetic in Sans Soleil, like those Goldstein paintings, and kind of like the movie Predator also, there's this heat mapping where everything seems to exist like as an aura. And for these, I painted the surfaces black and then covered them with epoxy. So, you know, if you paint something black and then you put a transparent layer over it, it becomes reflective. And the surfaces once again took up this kind of watery, toxic characteristic. And then I printed these jungle images on top. The result is almost like they were printed on a puddle. And once again, I leaned one against the mantle there, this time on four loco cans to kind of emphasize the jungle vibe. Is that funny? I guess it's funny. Four loco. Okay. All right, so this is Goya's untitled painting. It's usually called The Dog, which I had misremembered as being called The Drowning Dog. He painted it directly onto the wall of his house as an old man, along with another of other works collectively known as the Black Paintings. These paintings, which he never intended to be displayed, are like looser and wilder than any of his other output. To me, this one is especially incredible. It looks like the dog is swimming in the ocean, about to just get annihilated by a wave that it won't be able to overcome, but it's swimming on anyway. And there's also just something so funny and like stupid about that. I had this like dual read of it being tragic and comic at the same time, kind of like an analogy of what it means to be alive, and then also sort of like an artist's self-portrait. So I used this as an inspiration for a new video work. I found this short video of a pit bull running on YouTube. I turned it upside down, distorted it, and added an audio track that I also found on YouTube called Jungle Sounds. You can find anything on YouTube, obviously. I changed the color of the video to mimic the palette of the rest of the show. And this time, instead of encasing the monitors in these plexi boxes, I just sort of poured epoxy directly onto the screens and then made a print of the texture of canvas on top of that with the silicone mold, which brought it back to all the other earlier work and also just created this really unique, weird surface. And there's something I think rhythmic and hypnotizing about this video that I'm really drawn to. And I think with repeated viewing, like the Goya painting, it has a kind of tragic element to it. Here, I'll play a short clip, I think, or I won't. Motherfuck. John? Anybody got a joke or? Me in the studio again. So a week after my last show at Tilton Gallery, Jack died. Jack was the first gallerist to support my work, and we worked together closely for 4 years. His death was a great loss for me, as well as the other artists at the gallery, his staff, his family, and the greater New York art world. I'd also like to mention that in the interest of time, I didn't specifically credit anyone who helped produce any of this work. And in compiling my own personal history here, I realized that like there's so many other hands that go into this stuff. You know, that it's, I have the ideas, but that there's just so much other work that goes into it. It takes a village. So a small team of studio assistants, several different fabrication studios, at times gallery staff from Tilton, and my girlfriend have been an invaluable help in the development of my universe as an artist. And then I'd like to end here by showing you a little clip from the studio. This is me breaking glass by one of my preferred methods sometime last year. All right, so I'll open it up for questions. Thank you.
Okay, I'll get us started. With the showing that early on about the perspective...
the Martini Band, yeah.
Yes. Can you just sort of elaborate a little bit on the relationship of that painting and the lesson of perspective as it relates to your work? I mean, I thought it was interesting the way you dropped in these kind of art historical things and... connections could be made as you went on to the work, but you didn't necessarily like flesh that out for us. So was that intentional? And if it was or wasn't, can you kind of maybe talk about the perspective aspect just a little bit? Like, how does that relate to the way you think and work as an artist? How did that set you up as an artist, maybe?
Right. Well, you know, I didn't want to be pedantic to say, you know, this is this, and so here are the connections necessarily. And I like to leave things sometimes open-ended. But I do think that while, you know, a lot of this work that I showed, those early Italian paintings, are about perspective in terms of what's, you know, what's inside the work. My work is very much about perspective based on how you orient yourself, your body, in relation to it. That they just look different from wherever you're standing. Different time of the day, whatever angle, the distance, they can change colors. That's just a sort of a product of the mirror being encased in this plastic with this very specific surface. So although I hadn't sort of set out with that in mind necessarily when I started working on these, it was something that I pretty immediately noticed and became increasingly interested in. And, you know, maybe it's also just part of our tendency where we draw connections where we like to. Like, I love the history of painting. And so I'm always thinking about how my work relates to this or that. And sometimes it's exciting for me to try to be excited about something that maybe isn't typically thought of as exciting, and to try to kind of like, you know, nest religious painting from 700 years ago isn't usually thought of as like a thrilling subject matter. But I think there's a lot there to get excited about in terms of the creativity involved in it.
Yeah,
sure.
Yeah, I can kind of, you can see how one thing kind of leads into another, and your one work kind of built into other things. So where do you see, you know, kind of the next direction that you go in?
You got any ideas? So this, the last exhibition I did, I'm interested in this, this inkjet printing on this oil and plastic surface that I was doing with these jungle paintings. The jungle motif as whatever doesn't necessarily have to be that. I'm exploring where to go from that for perhaps my next exhibition. I was also thinking about, I have this kind of like constant in my work of these broken glass paintings that in order for me to stay excited about them, I try to change them and move them along so that I'm not just doing the same thing every day. While I was making some of these underpaintings, I was just making these like dumb abstract paintings in the studio, something I hadn't done in so long. And I got into it and I started to like them, but felt that they weren't as themselves perhaps interesting enough to be a finished work. So I'm thinking about kind of incorporating that into a series of broken mirror paintings where I make the abstract oil paintings on top of a mirror. Yeah, I mean, that's all I got right now.
Do you think you'll ever find yourself going back to 16 millimeter working with that, or are you just solely just like focused in on painting?
I like that question a lot. 16 millimeter is like a really complicated thing because it was invented to be a consumer medium, right? It was like dirt cheap. It was used for experimental filmmaking and like rich people's home movies who could afford to buy a camera that was better than like an 8mm. But it was not in any way fetishized. It was a consumer medium. And I love it. It's like such a beautiful thing. It has the most beautiful presence. I love all the parts of it. I love the material. I love the projection. I love the way it throws light. I love processing it myself. But I just like, I can't get behind the fetishism that's going on with it now because it's so outmoded. It's almost like maybe if I was going to make a film, it would be more real and honest to make it with my iPhone. And I'm not necessarily interested in doing that. But, you know, like, do I want to buy Kodak film on eBay and then, like, send it to, like, the one weirdo in Kansas who still processes it? And, like, I don't know. And where am I going to edit it? Am I going to have to edit it on a computer? I'm going to have to, like, rent a like a time with a Steenbeck flatbed editor. So as that material or as that sort of, you know, methodology has been phased out and become outmoded, I'm reluctant to engage with it. But if it were still something that wasn't so restricted, I would absolutely still be making it. When I was making the 16mm films, there was still a whole neighborhood of Manhattan that was almost solely devoted to film labs. I kind of came into it at its death, at like the moment right before, so that at one point, one of the guys, the lab guys that I was working with, asked me if I wanted to take his flatbed editor, which was worth like tens of thousands of dollars, but you know, it's also like 5,000 pounds, so I wasn't going to like drag it back to my apartment, if that answers your question.
With that, I hadn't thought of it before, but is there a relationship between your use of the mirror and the cracking and all of that in relationship to projection? Is there any relationship between, I guess it's kind of the opposite, right? Mirror coming back at you and projection going.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I have an inclination to work serially, and I think that there's certainly a read for some of this work to look at it like frames, to sort of read it the way that you read film. And it is also about light, the way that film is, of course, about light. But I think that that's probably just, like, who I am and where I got my start and how my kind of initial foundational programming set me out on my course. So I don't think about it as being part of, like, a trajectory, but I think it, you know, it's in there somewhere for sure. It certainly is.
Ready to call it a night?
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
That's it.
Thanks, guys.